Good morning. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 9.5 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Tuesday, January the 8th. So did you watch The Daily Show or the Colbert Report last night? They went back on the air last night with fresh shows, but no writers. Jon Stewart wore a fake unibrow and Stephen Colbert a fake beard to show solidarity with the striking writers, but why are they back on the air anyway? Are you glad or sad? 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890, 263-1890. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. During my last open line, a listener did request that we do a program on this ongoing strike by the Screenwriters Guild, its effect on television, the implication it holds for unionized labor. We will talk about that. We'll also talk about how last week the late night shows with Dave Letterman and Jay Leno and Conan O'Brien and Craig Ferguson all went back on the air last week with fresh shows, but under different circumstances. And it was also announced yesterday that the Golden Globes Awards show would be on Sunday, but as a news conference, a two-hour news conference, rather than the star-studded festival that it usually is. But what do you think about all this? What questions do you have? 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. We are happy to have with us Robert Thompson, founding director of the Bleier Center for Television and Popular Culture, a professor of media studies at Syracuse University, and the author of a number of books, including Television's Second Golden Age. And he joins us by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning.
So did you watch either Stewart or Colbert last night?
I watched them both.
Yeah, I wasn't able to, so I'm going to have you tell us how they went, starting with Stewart. Was it a good show?
Well, it was a good show, although this is a program, you know, the interview shows, the talk shows, it's easy enough to do without a script. You forego the all the jokes in the monologue, or you have the host make them up himself or pull them out from a hat. You get rid of the desk humor, and then you just make the interviews longer. It's a relatively simple thing to do. The problem with these Comedy Central shows is they are almost exclusively scripted. They're almost written from start to finish, and while listening to Jon Stewart ramble on is actually very, very amusing, I think they are going to have a lot harder time in the long run. I mean, Leno could keep doing this for months without writers. I don't think Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert are going to be able to do that without vastly changing their shows.
Yeah, so Stewart did have an interview with somebody about the writer's strike.
He did. I mean, he talked about the writer's strike for virtually the entire show, which I hope goes away. One of the things that we really miss about those programs is that both Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert, I think, have really become an important part of the civic conversation in this country. And I don't think it's being too hyperbolic to say that some of the work they've been doing has been really important to the political conversation that we have. And it's why we've missed them so much, especially in an election cycle like this. They got into virtually none of that last night. It was almost all strike-related stuff, which is going to get old really quickly. And it was interesting, in both cases, we have to remember that they are, in fact, crossing picket lines to do these shows. It's a backdoor scab kind of situation, yet they are being so careful, at least Jon Stewart, to show their solidarity to the writer's strike. Stephen Colbert, I think, was able to do the funniest thing, which is because he plays that kind of ultra-conservative 24-hour cable talk show kind of guy, he spent a good portion of the program reviewing all of his anti-union statements that he said in the past. So he came right out and said, I'm completely consistent. I'm against the strike. I'm against the unions and all of this kind of stuff. It was very, very funny and kind of a relief from some of this kind of hyper-solidarity kind of stuff by people who have, in fact, crossed picket lines to do it.
Yeah. And what he made some kind of comment that there was no words written in his teleprompter, and he thought that that magically had appeared.
Yeah, he killed he killed a good 45 seconds doing that. The most interesting thing, though, was on Jon Stewart when he was doing this interview with a labor professor. He implied, came out and essentially said, for example, that they had tried, in fact, to do a separate deal like Letterman had done, and apparently the WGA refused it because they're owned by Viacom, which is one of the big negotiating production empires going on here, as opposed to Letterman, who owns his own show. They allowed to have this separate deal. I didn't know that, and that's kind of interesting, that the writers are picking and choosing who they do these separate deals with, and if you're part of one of these big organizations, I guess you can't you can't do it. And then Stewart went on to do a very funny bit how he speculated that this was anti-Semitism because he was a Jew and the Letterman wasn't. That's why he allowed it. And then Jon Stewart said, the whole reason I got into this business is I thought we controlled it.
Yeah.
Very funny.
I didn't understand. I didn't understand that. I knew that Letterman owned his own company and that he did strike a deal with the writers.
Right.
And so that's why he is back on the air with the blessing of the writers. They're saying, hey, big stars, you can go on to Letterman, but don't go on to Leno or these other ones.
Right, and that was the deal. Because Letterman does own his own show, he was able to make, as an independent, this kind of deal. Now, Jon Stewart implied that they tried to do that, and he also implied that they had gotten Viacom to agree with it and give it their blessing, but the Writers Guild wouldn't go along with it. That's kind of interesting, because it means that if you are owned by any of these big boys that are being so intransigent, and then they're not going to make a deal with you.
Yeah, so how, I mean, no big stars are probably going to be showing up on the Daily Show or the Colbert Report, and they need writers to do the type of show that they typically do. So you're not hopeful that these programs are going to have much success.
Well, I think they're going to have the hardest time. Letterman, of course, is going on business as usual. He's got a contract and everything's fine. Conan O'Brien has decided to turn this whole thing into kind of a bit of surrealism, and his shows are actually more interesting now without writers than they were before.
How so?
Well, it's just that he's decided that this is going to be a completely different show. He used to do, you know, this sketch and this sketch and this bit and this bit. Now he, on his first night back, they did a film that must have gone for, I don't know, 15 minutes, where they just take him, he goes up to his office and he does riffs on the junk that's up there. He decides to time how long he can spin his wedding ring, and that lasts about 10 minutes. And then he does it again later on, and it lasts another 5 minutes. It's almost as though we're seeing, a kid without an instruction book try to play with his toys sort of stuff. And it's really funny, though I'm not sure how long it'll work. So those guys are doing their own thing. I think these Comedy Central shows are going to have a really hard time, though anybody that watched them has got to be suspicious that this was not just ad-libbed stuff. I mean, even though it was a different kind of show, even though they didn't have the usual kind of smooth scripted stuff, this did not look like a program which was completely being made up as they went along. And I don't know whether they're calling it writing or not, but there is certainly some preparation in these shows.
Yeah, I'm looking at an account of the toss-off between Stewart and Colbert, where they do at the end of the show. Stewart said hello to Colbert, who was seen shredding a script.
Right. And then he got his beard stuck in it, and he shredded his beard.
But then he said, I'm very alarmed by how prepared you seemed, Colbert said. I will be making a phone call.
Yeah, and that was all done as a joke, but I think it was what a lot of people were thinking, was that this really didn't, I mean, they had the graphics, and of course you can do graphics without writers and stuff like that, but this is where I think it becomes problematic when you cross the picket line and come back, and the idea is, okay, we're coming back without writers. But the question really, I think, is got to be asked as to, you know, how not written is this thing, and how is it they're preparing it? And it could be that it's just being done by, staff people who aren't part of the guild. That's how the soap operas came back in 1988. But the shows are not as different as you would expect them to be, especially a program that's scripted from soup to nuts like these shows are.
Yeah. Well, so Professor Thompson, did Stewart and Colbert, I mean, who forced them to cross this picket line? It was their decision, was it not?
It was, and they've got one bit of moral high ground that they can take, and all the late night people who have crossed the picket lines have said this, which is that they've got entire staffs that are making these shows, not just writers. Matter of fact, they've got a lot more staff members who aren't writers, and if they continue to stay off the air, all of those people, in effect, get laid off and become unemployed. So the sense that they've kind of taken this role that they are the paternal heads of these shows, they're responsible for their families of people to continue to have work, so that they're coming back for that reason. Before the agreement was made, Letterman was, in fact, paying his own staff out of his own pocket, keep them from losing their jobs, and Leno and the other talk shows followed after that. So that's the one bit of moral high ground that they've got. Now, Letterman, of course, is out of the problem. He's not crossing a picket line, but the rest of them really do still have to, for all of their support of the Writers Guild that they're saying on the air, they've got some real rhetorical tap dancing that they've got to do, because essentially, by putting on new material, they are weakening the negotiating ability of the strike, which is what, of course, the whole principle of the strike is about. And I suppose they can say we're putting people back to work, and I suppose they can say we're using our pulpit to support the strike. But nevertheless, they're crossing a picket line when they do it, and in case we don't remember that, they actually showed the picket line as the moment of zen at the end of The Daily Show last night.
Well, let's see what our listeners think. 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890. Are you happy or not that Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert have crossed the picket line and started fresh shows without writers? The Daily Show and the Colbert Report returned to the airwaves last night. Last week, we know the other late-night talk shows returned. David Letterman, the only one of them that did strike a deal with the Writers Guild. The rest of them did not. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Plus, any questions you have about why the writers are striking, or how long this is going to last, or what effect it's going to have on what we watch on television, including the Comedy Central offerings. Our guest is Robert Thompson. He is founding director of the Bleier Center for Television and Popular Culture, a professor of media studies at Syracuse University. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Coming up later this morning, more on the New Hampshire primary after 9 o'clock with Kathleen Dunn and her guests. Also during At Issue with Ben Marins, and special programming tonight after 7 o'clock, NPR news coverage of the results of the New Hampshire primary. We'll certainly be talking about presidential politics tomorrow morning as well, probably after 7 o'clock. In this hour tomorrow, talking with Michael Pollan, who is the author of a new book on food called In Defense of Food, An Eater's Manifesto. That's coming up tomorrow during this hour. Right now, we're talking with Robert Thompson. He is the director of the Bleier Center for Television and Popular Culture at Syracuse University, also a professor of media studies there. We're talking about the Writers Guild strike and the new developments in that strike, with a lot of the late night TV shows going back on the air last week, and then last night, Comedy Central's popular programs, The Daily Show with Jon Stewart and The Colbert Report with Stephen Colbert. And did I read, Professor Thompson, that he was calling himself Colbert?
Yeah, for the duration of the strike, it is no longer The Daily Show, it's A Daily Show. And for the duration of the strike, it's no longer The Colbert Report, it's The Colbert Report.
Colbert.
Which is how a lot of people have been pronouncing it anyway.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, you want to review for us the issues behind this strike? Why are the writers on strike?
Yeah, well, it's highly complicated, and I don't know all of the various things they're negotiating for. But needless to say, the big issue is residual formulas for all of the ways in which content is now used for profit other than being on TV. So they've been negotiating television rights for years, since there's been television, essentially. Now it's the idea of all of this money that's being generated through internet downloads, cell phone things, all of these new technologies, which currently many of the writers are getting nothing for at all. And then it's also going back and revisiting home video, in this case now the enormous DVD market that has emerged since the last negotiations. They always thought that they had been kind of stiffed on the formula for paid by DVDs. They do get some pay for it. They think they should be getting about twice as much. I think it's 4 cents per unit DVD as opposed to 8 cents, which they're asking for. And that's a big sticking point as well. So essentially, the new technologies are what's at stake here. And we could have seen this coming from miles away, because clearly, over the last several years, we have had an absolute revolution in the distribution of television content, and nobody wants to give an inch as they try to settle this territory. I mean, this is almost like a land rush kind of thing, where everybody's trying to put their fences around their portion of this new real estate, and the decisions they make now are going to be potentially really big ones that could have long-term effects. My long-term guess is what's going to happen is they're eventually going to come up with a solution to this. They've got to. It may take a long time, but they're going to come up with some solution. But I've got a feeling every single time they come up with for a new contract, new technologies are going to continue to develop apace. I've got a feeling we may see these strikes on a really regular basis now, not every 20 years.
Yeah, well, how we've heard that this particular strike could go on for about a year. Does it look like they're going to resolve it sooner than that?
Well, it sure doesn't look very promising. I mean, right this minute, as we speak, there's virtually no light at the end of the tunnel. They're not even at the table at this point. The networks have all figured out what they're going to do. They've announced schedules. It's clear that there's not going to be new scripted shows now for the rest of this season, even if it ends relatively soon. It's looking very much like the pilot season for next year is going to be compromised. The only, I suppose, bright spot in this is that if enough of these a la carte deals get made, David Letterman's Worldwide Pants has already done it for his two shows, his own show and Craig Ferguson's. It looks like United Artists is coming up with an a la carte deal. If in fact, the Writers Guild is able to patch together enough of these coalitions of independent interim deals, that really puts the moral pressure of this even more so on these big guys, because the public opinion then says, well, look, these other places are able to come up with deals. What is your problem? And it makes them look like they're the ones who are holding this all back. So I suppose if enough of those things happen, if they keep peeling away layers of the onion with separate deals, that does put some additional pressure on the big ones. But right now, I don't know. It doesn't look like this is going to be solved anytime in the near future.
Yeah, let's take some calls. Marilyn in La Crosse. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I was just listening last night, and my husband and I both watch The Daily Show and The Colbert Report on a regular basis, and we get lots of our interesting little takes on the news from them. I think as long as they keep the writer's strike in the public eye every single night, they're going to have to do something special about the writer's strike, because that's going to be very important, because otherwise the public will forget that they're on strike.
And I think I think you're right. I think that is how they are. They're sleeping at night. I mean, that's how they're justifying crossing the picket line, in my opinion, which is the idea that You're right. The writer's strike is currently the kind of story du jour, but if it does go on for a year, people lose interest in this stuff quickly. And I think their argument is going to be that by us going on the air, yes, we crossed the picket line, but it's for the nobler idea that we're taking this fan base who likes our show, and we are constantly going to hammer home what this strike is about, what its issues are, and all the rest of it. Jon Stewart spent the entire night talking about it, and Colbert, in his own unique way, spent the entire night talking against the writer's strike, but that's what he does in all of these things anyway. The big question is going to be, how long is the fan base going to stay interested in that, even in the Daily Show and the Colbert Report? Clearly, they're not going to be able to spend entire episodes on it, or people are going to quit watching. And then what are they going to do for the other 20 minutes if they're using 10 minutes each weeknight to remind us about it? So they've got a really tough job ahead. I don't envy either one of them or the staffs that are putting on those shows.
Yeah, thanks, Marilyn. And the fan base is the ratings for these programs and the other late night shows really did take a hit while they were in repeat, didn't they?
Right. I mean, these are the kind of shows that just don't repeat well. You watch them to see what happened the day before. You don't watch them to see what happened the week before or 3 weeks before. The caller made one other interesting point, though, that I think I hate to sound like a broken record, but she pointed out this idea that she watches this show to get an interesting perspective on the news of the day and all the rest of it. And I think we can't emphasize enough how important those two shows, more so than the talk shows. But I think since the turn of the century, what Jon Stewart was doing when the rest of television news had dropped the ball on stories like the lead up to the war, everybody was worried that they were going to be painted with the same unpatriotic brush as the Dixie Chicks or Bill Maher, and they really backed off on prosecuting that story of the lead up to the war. And then you had Comedy Central, this little cable comedy show, hammering away at the kinds of things and the kinds of stories that CBS and CNN ought to have been doing and should be ashamed of themselves that they weren't doing. When I hear that a lot of young people get their news from The Daily Show, I think, well, that's not good if that's the only place they're getting their news, but they could do a lot worse than having that as one of the places that they get their news.
Yeah, and you're hoping that we will get some presidential primary candidate commentary of some sort on these shows and not just long interviews about the writers.
Right, it did start a little bit on Jon Stewart began to ease his way into that a bit, and I imagine that there's a lot of candidates that would love for these shows to stay off the air until the election. Mm-hmm. They've gotten a lot of passes on some, for example, the presidential press conference that said about the intelligence report. I was so upset that we couldn't watch the Daily Show's and the Colbert Report's take on that afterwards, because it was so Kafkaesque. And those comedy shows, I think, are better positioned than journalists to sort of point out that kind of thing. And that's what we really count on them for, but that's hard to pull off without writers.
Thank you very much, Marilyn, for the call. John in Onalaska is next. Hi, John.
Hi. Yes, do you see any chance that some channels or some providers of entertainment might look at the market and say, my gosh, there's terrible TV shows on nowadays, and perhaps start to import things from France or India or China, where movies are also being made?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, and I think that people are looking at all possibilities for opportunities for new content, and I actually think they were doing that before the strike as well. You've now got so many different channels. There's such an enormous appetite for new material, and we are a not significantly less ethnocentric country now than we were a generation ago, but we're moving in a direction where we actually do now tend to be open to the popular culture of other nations more than we were a generation ago, when there was virtually none of that stuff coming in the other direction into this country. So that's a possibility. I don't see, though, even if this writer's strike goes on for a long, long time, that we are ultimately going to change the mix of what becomes the major mass-viewed stuff from one that goes from practically 0% international stuff to any significant kind. But you never know. And the reason it could happen is that you know, at first people said, oh, if this writer's strike goes on and there's nothing but reruns and bad replacements, people will go start playing board games and having conversations and going outside. I don't think that's going to happen. I think they're going to continue to watch television as much as they did before. They're just going to start flipping the dial to find stuff they haven't seen before. And if the rest of that dial starts providing other kinds of stuff, as you point out, some cable channel deciding to import the best of India or the best of China or whatever, you could get fans of those shows as they're flipping through who start to like them and then just don't come back when the writer's strike is over. Even now, people are discovering, you know, you got these great shows out there like FX, a channel doing some extraordinary work that a lot of people didn't even know was on their cable dial. They may find it during this period.
Yeah, we're finding, though, right now, virtually all of the, I don't know, the major primetime series, all those TV shows are stopped or in repeat now.
Right. Right. They've either stopped or in their repeats. However, that having been said, in the next 2 months, there are a dozen new scripted shows that were already in the can that are coming out on network and on cable, some of which are very, very good. There's this thing called In Treatment on HBO about five patients of a psychiatrist, a different patient each day of the week, a five-day-a-week show. It is absolutely extraordinary, and it's about to debut, I think, January 20th, right in the middle of this arid period of the strike. So there's stuff in the can. However, that's going to run out pretty quickly.
Yeah. I Leo Duran, my producer, tells me that some networks like CBS, which owns Showtime, will start putting some of their, you know, their cable offerings on the CBS network, like Dexter.
Yeah, well, that's going to be kind of, yeah, I mean, that could happen, too. I mean, with all of these, the big evil empires that are holding out on this strike, of course, have got cable channels and broadcast channels and all these other kinds of things, and it would be possible, and we know that even shows that you would have never imagined possible to play on broadcast, Sex and the City and The Sopranos, for example, have broadcast versions prepared, so they are running on commercial channels now, and that would be another possibility. On the other hand, you're messing with some really complicated equations there, because if they start using their pay cable stuff to sort of subsidize their schedule over on the regular thing, not only do they got to change the content so they're within compliance with indecency rules and stuff, the other thing they have to worry about is what then keeps their subscriber base on their pay channels if they're starting to use it up elsewhere. But yeah, that's another thing that has been discussed.
Yeah. So I see a bunch of ads on Bravo for Who Wants to Be a Supermodel. I don't even know if that's a new reality show or not, but these reality shows are going to keep on cropping up.
Oh, yeah, and that was going to happen before the strike. I mean, in many ways, reality was stimulated by a threatened strike at the turn of the century, which never happened. But those things were, most of the reality shows that we're seeing now that people are blaming on the writer's strike were reality shows that, in fact, had either been made or planned before the writer's strike. But as they're developing new shows, as they're looking to the fall, for example, if you've got no writers, you've really got basically two opportunities: hour-long news magazines and reality shows. You've got no sitcoms, you've got no dramas, none of that kind of stuff. So the longer this goes, the more it's going to stimulate the continuation of reality TV. And it's already gotten to the point where, you know, Clash of the Choirs seems to be going pretty deep into the well.
Well, is there anything, you know, we can do about this in terms of as being television watchers, or do we just have to? I'm just wondering if there's who has the upper hand here? Aren't we're going to be sick of this and not watch TV anymore? Or maybe. What do you think?
Well, I mean, not really. I suppose that there was some, you know, enormous public outcry that began to you know, somehow boycott advertisers of any place that was not making a deal with you know, the writers or whatever. I mean, I suppose one could do that, but you know, we have a hard enough time getting people to in that kind of organization about really important sorts of issues. I don't think it's going to happen over this. I think this is the entertainment industry's problem. I think we suffer in some ways, in significant ways, like the lack of the Daily Show and the Colbert Report. I think that was an important civic suffering when they were off the air. But I think this is one of those labor dispute things that's going to have to play out, and it is going to eventually be solved. These writers and producers and networks are not going to decide, okay, there'll be no more industry for scripted material anymore. The appetite is too big, and the potential for money across the board is too enormous for it to go on forever. But as we've seen, even if this ends tomorrow, this got pretty ugly, and I think it's going to get uglier before it's over.
We're talking with Robert Thompson. He is founding director of the Blyer Center for Television and Popular Culture and a professor of media studies at Syracuse University. We're talking about the Writers Guild strike and new developments in the strike or related to it. A couple of favorite Comedy Central programs went back on the air last night. Fresh programs without writers, The Daily Show and The Colbert Report. Last week, the other late night shows went back on the air with fresh shows, including Leno and Letterman. Letterman struck his own deal with the writers, so he's on the up and up with the Writers Guild. The other late night shows did not. And the Writers Guild is suggesting that big name stars boycott these other shows like Jay Leno and not cross the picket lines to appear on them. What about you? Are you watching these shows? What do you think? And what questions do you have about this strike and what it's doing to TV? 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up after 9 o'clock, Kathleen Dunn will talk with the president of Project Vote Smart and with Air America radio host Rachel Maddow. That's coming up after 9 o'clock, talking politics with Kathleen Dunn and her guests. We're talking about the writer's strike. The strike by the Writers Guild of America, and welcoming your questions and thoughts on this for our guest, Robert Thompson, who is with Syracuse University, and Ron in Wapaka is our next caller. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I really admire these writers for standing up. The Big Six, General Electric, Time Warner, Walt Disney, News Corp, CBS, and Viacom, try to make it sound like to the Springer crowd, like it's the individual shows that these writers are striking against, when actually they're striking against a bunch of billionaires, and that's a hard bunch to go up against. They've already got stiffed once, as you said earlier, and we've already got problems with reality shows because they're so doggone cheap, and this is nothing but another Reagan air controller thing where they're trying to bust the unions. And they're going after, they're trying to get these unions split up and fighting against each other and everything. This is no different than the race baiting in Mississippi 20 years ago. And I really admire these strikers for standing up, and I hope they make it. I'm not sure they will, but I hope they do. I'm a guy that hasn't bought a Cornish game hen in 10 years because of the Jefferson thing with Tyson.
Oh.
You know, and I hope they make it. But in these times, magazine's got a fantastic article that explained this whole thing better than anything I've read in January.
Thank
and
you,
I,
Ron.
I
and
think
Ron,
that's great.
Ron supports those writers going against those big production companies. What do you think? Will they be successful, Robert Thompson?
Well, I mean, there's going to be the question is what degree of success. There's going to be some kind of agreement, and these producers, I think, are going to have to give something before that happens. The question is it going to make the formula as fair as it ought to be? I agree with the caller insofar as we really ought to remember the fact that in the end, these industries exist. Those Big Six are generating billions of dollars because of content. It's just like an auto industry exists because of cars. People buy them and drive them around. The rubber hits the road in this industry with the content, and that, for the most part, lies first and foremost with the writers. There's some exceptions to that, but the vast majority of programs are still made by the writers. So the question is, where is the formula of how they get compensated for this? It's been hard, I think, for a while, although I think that's changing, to get the kind of public sympathy for Hollywood writers the way one can for other branches of labor. When other workers go up against the big corporations, and they're workers who have to punch in a time clock, and they've got dirt under their fingernails and all of that kind of thing, it's easier, I think, for the average American to get sympathy for those workers against these big billionaires. The problem has been, I think, with the writers is that in this country, though we love watching what Hollywood produces, we've got a really bad attitude towards Hollywood. We're cynical about it. We think these are a bunch of people lunching at the Beverly Hills Hotel and driving around their fancy cars and all the rest of it. And I think it was hard in the beginning for people to become sympathetic for any party in this thing. They saw it as a bunch of really rich people greedily negotiating to become richer and richer and getting a bigger slice of it. I think that is beginning to change, and I think the caller is a perfect example of that, where this is now being framed more. I think more people are being communicated with the idea that most of the people in the Writers Guild don't even work very often. There's only a very small percentage of them that are fabulously wealthy, and that a lot of them really depend to keep themselves, in a roof over their head between jobs on these residuals that that come in. And this is where I think these talk shows that have crossed the picket line could actually do something really interesting. They could, in fact, start inviting writers to be on the show to talk about what it is that they're striking about, and then they could invite the executives of these producers and networks to come on. Now, at first, the producers and networks wouldn't come on, and wisely so, because the deck would be so totally stacked against them, because they'd be in unfriendly territory, and writers are funnier and better able to communicate stuff to an audience. But if they kept inviting them, and they kept bringing the writers on and saying, we keep calling Viacom, we keep calling Time Warner, they won't come on, eventually that would really put the pressure on those producers to come in and give their side of the story. And if you could start having some of these negotiations done in a bread and circuses environment of a comedy talk show, you might be surprised at how Jon Stewart said last night when he was talking to the labor leader, look at all we just got done in 6 minutes. Why can't they? You might be able to get some interesting stuff done if they force the hand of this discussion to take place in front of the public.
Well, they might have to, like Leno might have to invite other guests other than stars, because aren't they having trouble getting stars on there? I read that Leno's going to appear on whatever, Jimmy Kimmel's show, and Jimmy Kimmel's going to appear on Leno's show because
they're the only ones that will appear on each other's show. It's like Bob Hope and Jack Benny. But that's true. I mean, this would be a way to kind of justify their having crossed the picket line. It would take some doing for them, I think, to get the other side to come on, however, because that would be really dangerous territory for them to move into. And I think in that court, they would probably inevitably end up looking bad and losing. They'd have to really finesse it in a way that they made it so that these people had to come on, and then turn these talk shows into a sort of public forum airing these kinds of disputes. I don't think it's going to happen, but it's certainly possible.
Yeah. Glenn in Stoughton is with us now. Hi, Glenn.
Hi. I had a question that I don't know if I've heard anybody bring up is, aren't the hosts of these shows, like Conan O'Brien, Stephen Colbert, Jon Stewart, members of the Writers Guild? And if so, how are they able to do anything on their shows if they are writers?
Yeah, this is an important and complicated question. The way I understand it, and this is the way Leno, in fact, explained it on the first night that he came back last week, is yes, they are all members of the Writers Guild. A few aren't. Carson Daly, I don't think, is a member of the Writers Guild, but the ones that you mentioned and the ones that we've been talking about are. Leno said on his first day back that while he's a writer, he's a member of the Writers Guild, and he's not allowed to write scripts. Presumably, he is allowed to kind of get up there and do his monologue, and he did do a monologue, which he claimed to have written himself and to have run by his wife, and he thanked his wife at the end of the monologue, and it was a long one. It was a couple of dozen different jokes that he told. Jon Stewart, on the other hand, didn't. He told one outright joke, and he then said that he took it out of the archive, and it had been grandfathered because it had been written before the before the strike. They are Writers Guild people, so they are crossing the picket line. It's the bottom line.
Yeah, and the Writers Guild is telling Jay Leno, quit writing your monologue, and he's saying, I'm going to continue to write my monologue.
That's right. He has really decided to go up against them. There's even a further complication where you're not supposed to be in character, if it was a character, of course, that was created under the regime of the Writers Guild contract. And that's where Colbert is in some dicey territory, because he's clearly, when he goes on the air, and that was true last night as much as any other time, he's not being Stephen Colbert the human being. He's being Stephen Colbert, this alter ego that mm-hmm. he's presented. And he's, I think, on pretty thin ice by playing his Hannah Montana role as opposed to going on there and being Miley Cyrus.
I get it. First I thought, what? Okay. Jenny and Madison, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I wanted to say my sister is a writer, and I'm very proud of her. She's on the picket lines every day, and this is an important issue, and I just really appreciate that it's on the radio. My key question is about the Golden Globes and the Oscars. Do you think that the actors are going to continue to side with the writers, and will it affect the award season?
Well, already affected the award season in that the Golden Globes were just announced yesterday that they're not going to have their show. They're going to do it as a press release.
A press conference
instead. Mm-hmm. And there'll even be a red carpet to the press conference. But the idea is nobody would be people are going to feel pretty silly doing that. So the Golden Globes broadcast as we know it is already off. The reason was not so much that you need writers. Frankly, I think the writing on award shows is probably among the very worst writing that goes on in all of television. You could have people simply go up, read the nominees. The acceptance speeches aren't written anyway. That wouldn't have been the big problem. The big problem was the SAG, the screenwriters, or the Screen Actors Guild, has asked their membership not to go to these award shows. If you don't have any of the people there to accept the awards, it's going to be a pretty boring show. So that's why they decided to simply announce it in this press conference sort of way. That sets the stage as to exactly how the Oscars may be treated if this strike is still going when that comes out, which means the shockwaves of this go further than simply the income lost by advertising on those highly rated shows. It also means that these award shows really impact the Hollywood film industry because, as we all know, award shows, Golden Globes, Oscars, whatever, are essentially big, long infomercials for the movies that have been nominated for these awards. So this continues to send out waves of impact that are beyond just the fact that we're not going to see show X, show Y, or show Z.
Yeah, so what we're going to see on Sunday or maybe for the Oscars is like just a C-SPAN news conference kind of a thing?
That's what it sounds like. Mm-hmm. And you had announced earlier, I think, that it was going to be 2 hours long. That could be, if it's that long, that could get really, really dull.
I thought I read somewhere that that's what they were talking about. But yeah, what a snooze that would be.
Yeah, a bunch of people in suits reading the names of the people that won. How exciting is that?
Yeah. Speaking of the movies, did Tom Cruise or was it United Artists that did strike a deal so some movies will be fresh sometime soon?
Yeah. Now, I'm not sure what the status this minute of that is, but, yeah, that's been being reported that United Artists has an a la carte deal, much like Letterman did, which will mean they'll be able to get moving again. I don't know if that's completely signed, sealed, and delivered or not, but that's been being reported for a couple of days, which will, of course, put them at a great advantage if that happens, because it takes a little longer to see the impact of this with movies because their turnover time is longer. But again, if this keeps going on, we're going to have not only the problem of networks not having shows to put on the air, we're going to have the problem of your 12-screen Cineplex not having movies, which may bring us back to the previous caller where we start bringing them in from Bollywood and France.
Mm, yeah. Jim in Salt Lake City listening on the web. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm a big fan of the TV show Lost, and it's kind of frustrating because their production cycle seems so slow to begin with. And I guess their show is going to start January 31st.
Right.
The producers haven't made a podcast. Are they going to be able to do a full season? Like, do you know how many episodes they've completed?
Yeah, they're doing 8 episodes. And the final episode apparently ends in a big cliffhanger, very similar to a typical Lost season ender cliffhanger. So what it's essentially going to be is 8 episodes with a cliffhanger at the end instead of 22 episodes with a cliffhanger at the end, and that'll be that. As you know, if you're a Lost fan, Lost tends to get off to slow starts in the beginning of seasons and tends to really kick in spectacular ways toward the end. If that's what's been was going to happen this season as well, just when the show starts hitting its stride, they'll be gone. And so Lost, 8 episodes, and that'll be it for the season. 24, of course, was shelved entirely. They would have had to call it 8.
Yeah, that's right. They had other problems, too, with what's his Bauer in jail.
Yeah, well, all right. That's, we could get into all that
so,
stuff, too.
Anyway, a bummer, Jim?
Oh, it is a bummer. It seems like the production was so slow because their cast members were getting arrested and they were taking them out of the plot line. So all 8 episodes have been completed. That's good news. I guess if the strike goes on, then we really won't know what happens to these people for like maybe another year then.
I'm not sure we're going to ever know what happens to those people ever, but that's a whole other story.
Yeah, it could be that it's a cliffhanger that never has a resolution. Rachel in Kenosha, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. Question, I have some friends that are laid off because of the writer's strike out in California, and as I understand it, the actors and the directors' contracts are going to be coming up in June.
That's right.
How does that sort of play into it? The way, I think I remember it 20 years ago, whatever deal that they might also come up with, the producers might help weigh in on what the writers can get.
Yeah, this is going to get more and more complex as we get closer to that other date. The directors have traditionally done their contracts way ahead of time, and they've generally been pretty amicable contracts. What was different this year is they decided not. They were going to start their negotiations right after the new year. They decided to put that on hold. And their reasoning was, if they came up with a contract with the producers, they thought that would give them more leverage against the writers because they'd have the directors in their pocket. If, in fact, the directors can't come up with a deal, the actors can't come up with a deal, then this gets even more complicated because then you get to the point where you begin to be able to essentially shut down the town. Now, reality TV shows, once again, don't have actors. They do, on the other hand, have directors and editors and all the rest of it. So if systematically, as these contracts come up, they all decide that they're going to hold out in the same way that the writers have and come up with a industry-wide solidarity, that at some point will reach a tipping point because then you begin to shut down any new programming at all. So we'll see as we get further on into the spring as to how that's going to play out.
Well, we are out of time for this hour. Do you think Jon Stewart will get rid of the unibrow, though?
He did. After he was on the screen for like 2 minutes, and it was gone. So that lasted about. And Colbert's beard didn't make it past the paper shredder.
That'll be it. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you,
Robert Thompson, founding director of the Bleier Center for Television and Popular Culture, and professor of media studies at Syracuse University. This is the Ideas Network.